Hello, I'm Miguel Perales, Deputy Chief of the Adult Bone Marrow Transplant Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Welcome to Metascape Oncology Insights, coming to you from the American Society of Hematology annual meeting in 2017. Today we'll be discussing some of the highlights of the CAR-T sessions at the meeting and more broadly where the field is going. And joining me in this discussion is Marcella Pasquini, Associate Professor at Medical College of Wisconsin and Senior Scientific Director at the CIBMTR. Welcome, Marcelo.
Thank you, Miguel.
So, Marcelo, now that we have two approved indications in CAR-T cells this year, in 2017, what are your thoughts on how we're going to bring this to the clinic and bring this to the real world?
It's really exciting times now with this approval of these two really potent live drugs for indications of acute leukemia, lymphocytic leukemia, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This is really a testament of a lot of work that came from several institutions in the United States and elsewhere, and that really proved to bring this over to available to patients. So we're living in unprecedented times. It's a really powerful drugs or living drugs, and for patients who have very aggressive diseases, these are coming in with a lot of challenges. These drugs are required they're very expensive. There are in a limited number of sites initially to be open, and it require a large amount of scrutiny to follow these patients for a long term.
Yeah, I mean, I know that we've spent now probably the better part of this year preparing for this moment. I mean, we've had multiple meetings with hospital administration, pharmacy, medicine, ICU team, nursing, just to sort of get the logistics lined up and implement this. And I think it's really bringing a whole new level in terms of the patient care, in terms of making sure that we do this safely for the patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that like bone marrow transplant, as we see, these patients require care, they're multidisciplinary. So as this is rolling out to the community, the centers have to be quite ready. Mm-hmm. Just from the baseline of identifying these patients and also the data, the day-to-day care of them, if they have to go to ICU, the post-care, and so forth. So it's a paradigm shift that we're seeing right now with these patients.
Yeah. I think one thing that's interesting in lymphoma is obviously the clinical trials were done under very specific circumstances and with very specific criteria. And if you look at the label, at least for the first product with Kite, it's basically, you know, relapsed lymphoma after two lines of therapy, which is quite a bit broader than what was on the clinical trial. I mean, there's no consideration for where the patients are being treated. We know that all the patients were being treated in-house, and the label doesn't talk to that. And even the usual criteria that you would have on a clinical trial not included. And so we've actually put together a group of transplanters and lymphoma docs and looked at the label and looked at the clinical trial inclusion and exclusion to say, okay, we're going to be okay with the label in this regard, but we're going to add some things that we feel are more appropriate in terms of clinical care. And what I've heard is that some insurance companies are actually saying, you know, the label is one thing, but we're just going to follow the inclusion and exclusion of the clinical trial and not go with the label, which is much broader. So I don't know if...
Absolutely. I think this is safety is paramount.
Yeah.
The trials were carefully designed to include patients who not only have relapsed refractory lymphoma, as you know, but they had to follow an absolute minimum of organ toxicity level or organ function level. So then when these patients do get sick, then your mortality does not increase. So I think that has to be translated. And we're seeing this in the centers that are participating, or at least the selected sites that are participating that can prescribe these CAR T cells, that they would need to have a good patient selection. So not only just because there is the right disease that you can do this, because there is a potential of the real world results being much worse than actually we saw in the trial. So I think that is really
important. I think that should really be a concern of the company too, right? Because they're the first ones out, and they don't want to have a lot of, you know, patients not doing well with their product. And I do have a concern, you know, as they move up from the experience center and larger centers to centers that may have never treated somebody, that they may start to sort of say, well, this is the label, and we're not going to look at, you know, other health issues in these patients and just go ahead, and that may not give us the same results.
Yeah. So I do like the what the companies set up in terms of training of the sites and having sort of a more cautioned rollout, so not starting with 90 sites at once, but starting with initial sites that had experience from them. But they also the requirement to have effect accredited in the immune effector cells, because that it's not only the physician and the patients were the physicians were seeing the patient, but it's the whole program that has to be prepared to take care of these patients. And I think having some sort of accreditation body or a set of sort of guidelines or guidance of how to treat these patients is really important to keep the safety on it.
Yeah, no, I think that rollout has been done quite carefully by both companies, and I think that's very smart on their part. The other thing I also struggle with and that we struggled with is the two different grading systems that we have and the fact that both different companies have sort of specific recommendations for how you manage the cytokine release syndrome, how you manage neurotoxicity, and their recommendations vary and the grading varies. And so not so much now where we're treating two different populations. The pediatricians will be treating acute leukemia. We will be treating the lymphoma patients. But imagine, a couple of months from now when we expect to have a second product approved with Novartis, that you may have on the same team at the same time on the clinical floor, patients getting two different products with maybe slightly different management systems recommended by the companies. And which grading system do you use, and how do you sort of put that into practice?
Yeah, no, I think this is really a testament of how novel all this this field is, right? And we are noticing that we have now a third version of these grading systems coming out. And I think the approach should be like we develop with graft-versus-host disease in the transplant field, right? And we had several revised criteria so we can evolve. I think one point that is very important that you bring up is the fact that we have to speak the same language to use the appropriate supportive care for these patients because to the point that we're treating grade 3 in one way and grade 2 the other and grade 4, that's going to be...
And it's not even the same grade 1 and 2 and 3
exactly,
and 4.
So, exactly.
Yeah, I worry about, the typical situation where the physician covering at night who's got many other patients gets called to the floor and then it's like, is it this product or that product? Which grading system am I using? And when do I use the tocilizumab? And that's the scenario we don't want. I think we want it to be very streamlined and to have sort of specific guidelines.
And I think that the publication from the MD Anderson group related to the CARTOX guidelines, I think it was going to be important as the first one because that one it really tells you about a comprehensive, multidisciplinary approach to treat these patients. Because, this is going to be very different from your clinical trial patient. This is going to be out the community. I mean, they're not going to be as scrutiny as you'd be in the clinical trials in terms of monitoring and auditing how these patients were. But now having these guidelines, I think centers could have a way to start at least and then follow up. This was just published earlier in 2017.
Yeah, no, I think that's a critical paper. And I think also that the ASBMT and EBMT are sort of working together to develop some guidance as well and thinking sort of very practical clinical terms. How can these two bodies sort of issue some guidance in terms of what's the best management? And then it's going to change over time, obviously, but at least to sort of have some very practical recommendations. And I think the other area that is still a big question mark is sort of the long-term follow-up. And so we know that since it's genetically modified T cells, we have this long-term follow-up requirement from the FDA. And it seems that that's still in flux. And obviously, the CIBMTR has been very active in that field. And maybe you want to talk to that some.
Correct. And so again, I think the word unprecedented that I used earlier is regarding this point exactly. I mean, it's the first time that we're seeing such a scrutiny of a commercial product that you have to follow these patients for 15 years. This requirement comes from the concern of having second cancers develop, although with this class of genetic manipulation, we have not seen this, have been reported that yet. But still, there is a cautionary tale of following up, not only second cancers, which is the primary, but if you have robust cells that will persist and all of a sudden now you have a young woman who becomes pregnant and these cells persist and carry and to the baby. So these are all really very important points that really increase the importance of following these patients. So the CIBMTR is a research organization that follows patients after a hematopoietic stem cell transplant. We've been doing this for more than 30 years. And we basically helped advance the field of transplantation by collecting the data, sharing the data, and allowing multiple investigators to use this data for research. But with that, we created a system that can follow these patients for a long time. Yeah. And we've been working with different commercial companies that FDA mandated that the patients will be collected for second cancers. And so we do have experience with that. And what we've seen the field change as it is right now, about 2 years ago, we initiated a project to basically create a outcomes registry for cellular therapy, thinking that this is going to come. Mm-hmm. So we have now launched this cellular therapy registry early in 2017, and it's fully operation to collect data. And I think the objective here is really large in a way that we want to create a standardized outcomes database that everybody could use. We don't want to be in a situation that each company has their own registry, mm-hmm. and then the centers that are using multiple of these products have to rely on one.
That's going to be a nightmare, right?
And you cannot have that. So having sort of a standardized way of collecting cellular therapy data would be very good for the field in a way that we can eventually compare these products and see what is the best for the patients. So in this cellular therapy registry, what we created is having input from the community, from the experts in the field, and also with our European and Japanese colleagues to harmonize. So if it's a global product, we are able to use the same language mm-hmm. if this is used in Europe or in Asia. And if we want to collapse the data or consolidate the data, that's going to be doable. So the system really mirrors what we have a lot of experience with transplant. So we follow these patients yearly. There is a mechanism which is similar to transplant again because centers are familiar to collect the data and collect the field. And one important thing is that we're not trying to transplant and take over the world of cell therapy,
but why not?
Is that true? but it is sort of a way of having a continuation, because we envision that these patients who will probably have a transplant before or after cell therapy or cell therapy are going to be used to compare to transplant. Yeah. So it would be ideal to have this situation so we can really decide what is the best treatment for the patients.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's really unique about transplant is that we're so data-driven, and you know, you can ask any transplant center, you know, what is your one-year survival for acute leukemia? What is your one-year survival for lymphoma? And they can give you that data. You go to the leukemia chief or the lymphoma chief and say, what's your one-year survival for leukemia induction? And I'll get back to you 2 weeks later.
Right.
And
right.
So I think we really have this mentality of being data-driven. And I think, especially as we imagine now that a year from now, we might have three different products in the lymphoma space, that being data-driven and being able to collect this data together is going to be critical.
And the other point is, with this follow-up, which will be critical, is what happens to the patients who go to Memorial, have one CAR T-cell for lymphoma, that doesn't work, goes to University of Pennsylvania, get the second one, that doesn't work, and then goes to a third one and gets a third
product. I've had that patient.
Yes, and then eventually gets a transplant.
Yes.
So who has the responsibility to follow these patients for 15 years? You know, is the first center or the last center? So all these things, having sort of a system that is standardized, that will help sort of track these patients as well to the centers, that will be ideal. I think that will probably be a benefit to the field.
Yeah. Now, I record this three CAR T's for one patient at three different sites.
Yes.
That's. I don't think it's going to be common, but we're certainly going to see some of that, especially as they developed CAR T's for other targets. So we've seen the nice work. Actually, Crystal Mackall presented some data at this meeting looking at the CD22 targeting in patients who failed CD19. And I think that Terry Fry and her have some very nice data showing that they can rescue patients with CD22 CAR Ts.
Yeah. It was fascinating that at ASH this year demonstrated some other methods of a mechanism of resistance, even because in acute leukemia it's seen that patients lose the CD19 antigen expression, but it has not been seen very much for lymphoma, but we saw some elements of that also happens with lymphoma with loss of antigen expression for CD19.
So, although it's going to be challenging, I think, financially to imagine that patients get two different CAR Ts.
Correct.
And what are your thoughts on combining CAR Ts? I know that there's been some discussion of dual targeting and whether you mix cells against two targets or whether you the same cell expresses the two targets.
So that's interesting. We just give to oncologists or hematology oncologists and then more is better,
yes.
Right? So if the one didn't work, increase the dose or add another agent.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's interesting. There are a few studies that combine CD19 plus CD20 or CD22 CARs. But I think Dr. Mackel mentioned in her talk is that that this is going to be financial really problematic. So one of the situations that she suggested was using these bispecifics or even tri or quad specifics that you basically look of a variety of different antigens in one single CAR within the same construct that can basically potentiate its effect. So I think that's probably the way it will go. The other important element is the combination therapy by trying to add immune checkpoint inhibitors to the CARs or modifying the CARs so the CARs have a little bit more regulated approach and you'll see less toxicity.
Yeah. No, I thought that was a nice part of her talk as well, where she talked about the exhaustion of the T cells and mechanisms to try and overcome that and sort of thinking about new delivery methods.
Yeah,
and that's
and
fascinating.
We are still really early in the fact that, also quoting her, that it's only on and off, right? You either see a 60-mile-per-hour car or you see a car not moving.
Yeah.
What you want to do is you want to have that throttle there that you can actually go up to speed when you need it and control. We can use car analogies all day. Right?
Yes. And then, you know, you talked a bit about, you know, being able to compare CAR Ts. And so imagine that we're in ASH 2018. It's very conceivable that we're going to have three approved products in lymphoma, right? We have Kite's approved today. Novartis is probably going to be approved in the next couple of months based on the, on their data. And Juno, you know, with very promising data being presented at the meeting, you know, is probably going to get approval also later next year sometime. And so I can certainly picture that next year we'll have three approved indications. And so, you know, what I struggle with is, you know, who's going to make that decision? Do I get to decide, you know, with the patient, we want to give you this car or that car, or is it just going to be the insurance company has a better deal with one of the cars? And do we think there's really data right now that could say, well, this one may be better or not, or safer or not? I think, you know, obviously the companies all want to tell you that theirs is better and safer, but what is your sense? I mean, knowing that we can't really compare side-by-side trials.
Right. I mean, I think that there's be a little bit of everything. I think as they roll out, they're going to probably go to some centers will be overlapped, but they may select centers that have only one product versus the other, so they have a little bit more usage of these, and you don't have that predicament of choosing one versus the other. The other possibility will be, you know, the constructs as we know, they are different. And it seems to be that there are differences in how they proliferate or expand initially and how they stay on the patient, you know, depending on if it's the 4-1BB or the C28 type of construct, they differ in that. But we don't have a way of comparing one way or the other. Even the pivotal trials that are being used for approval, they are very early. I mean, the Zuma trial has been presented with 8 months medium follow-up, which is rather early. I mean, when you compare, when you look at Zuma versus the Scholar patients that they presented at the meeting, of course, there is a really a fourfold or so better response. But the question is going to be if these the duration of response and how we're going to choose. But I think you pointed bringing up a very important question is how is going to be the selection process and which one are you going to use?
Yeah.
And it quite possibly that the insurance company would dictate at different sites. You know, this is the first, second, and third line.
Yeah.
And, and you know, you can imagine the third line car on you know, in terms of cost. I mean, this is also a consideration.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're looking at the different vectors. I mean, obviously you pointed out this, the co-stimulation is different. The rate of expansion is different. So that may be relevant in terms of the onset of toxicity. And certainly if you're trying to do this as an outpatient versus inpatient, if the delayed onset of toxicity may allow you to treat the patient outpatient and only admit them, you know, a few days later as opposed to having to admit them almost immediately. And that would certainly have an impact on capacity. And I was struck by the early data from Juno that their safety signal seems to be maybe a little bit better, but it's obviously very early data, and they're still in dose escalation phase, so we haven't really seen, you know, full data at the higher dose. But at least the preliminary data seemed interesting in that regard. And, you know, what they're using, obviously, the 4-1BB, which is the same as the Novartis product from Penn, but they do have the defined composition of cells and, you know, what that may be playing into it, or if it has nothing to do with that and it's just different manufacturing. I think there's so many questions.
Yeah, I mean, the issue was that the cells expanded quickly when you separated CD4 and CD8 and transduce them separately and then infuse them. So it is a different package if you put forward, right? I mean, it's not only you got one cell and you know it's a little bit a different product. So I think it's going to be really important that we in the same patient population we'll be able to compare the activities. And I think with the registry or the outcomes database, I think that's going to be doable. We hope that the companies really understand this is really important, that we could use the same mechanism for all of these products.
So I think this has been a fascinating discussion. I'm really, I think, you know, we need to make a date for next ASH, we'll have so much more to talk about.
Yes.
You know, we predicted this, and now we'll see if we were right or if we were wrong or if we were halfway there. Yeah. So, Marcelo, thanks a lot for joining me today. It's really been a great discussion. And thank you for joining us. This is Miguel Perales at ASH 2017 in Atlanta.